Okay, so you've sort of seen this already before in the sense that I know that you've had some acquaintance with the Einstein-Hilbert action, but I just want to go over it again because I want to emphasize a couple of points about deriving the Einstein field equations from a gravitational action. Because although, as long as you kind of keep your nose to the ground and follow through and just think about what's happening in a bulk of space-time, the Einstein action is just fine. There are a couple of subtleties, so some of which we're going to come back to when we start thinking about maybe using the action itself or modifying the Einstein-Hilbert action. So I guess if I want a title for today, call it the Einstein action. Although, of course, we know it's really Einstein-Hilbert action, but what it is we're thinking about variational principles and integration on manifolds. So let's just recall some of the important things about integration on manifolds. So it's useful to have an action principle. We can say it links to field theory. It also, I've been talking about Euclideanization. I haven't really sort of done it formally, but I've been mentioning it to kind of get you used to the idea that we don't just have to do space-time. We can think about analytically continuing our gravitational solutions, and these are related to tunneling processes. So whenever you calculate a tunneling process, what you're really doing is you're thinking about metastable states decaying into something that's more stable or completely stable, and you want to calculate probabilities. How do you calculate a probability? You kind of have to compute an action for the process. So we need to also think about an action principle so we can compute. So it links to field theory. So it's also useful if we're calculating instantons and actions. And of course, I'll put it. It links to a sort of Euclidean quantum gravity type of approach to thinking about quantum gravity really from a rather semi-classical point of view. It's not particularly well defined, but again, if you kind of keep your nerve and tread a very narrow path, you can get some sensible results out of Euclidean gravity. So, good idea to have an Einstein action. So, we've already discussed things like tensor densities or the concept of a density, where when you make a coordinate transformation, something transforms almost geometrically, but it has a factor of a determinant of the coordinate transformation in it. So, let's just remind ourselves of what the invariant measure is if we're going to integrate on a manifold, because our sort of volume, our little unit of volume has just by, if we look at the coordinates d4x, we get the Jacobian of the coordinate transformation. And so in order to make an invariant volume measure, we add in the factor of a square root of the determinant of the metric. So this is really thinking about the s to the fourth rather than just the x. I suppose I'll put mods around. So we saw how our determinant of the metric transformed. And so we can see that our invariant volume measure is really not just the coordinates, but also this factor of the square root of the determinant of the metric. So this is really telling us what our invariant volume element is. And it's coming from our idea of the, this would be in three-dimensional space, that the volume is really like a sort of three-form. So this is where our root G is coming. You can think of it that way. So that tells us what we need to put in when we integrate over the manifold, what our measure is. And if we are doing a variational principle for gravity, then we're going to need to know how to vary the quantities that we have in our action with respect to the dynamical variable of gravity, which is the metric. So G is what is our sort of field, the distances in gravity, distances between A and B are our observables. So that's what we're actually looking at when we think about gravity. So G is our field, and that's what we've got to vary with respect to. So we need to know how to vary our metric, or the determinant of our metric. And so in order to vary that, we use a useful identity, which you may well have met, which is for a matrix, the determinant is the exponential of the trace of the log of the matrix. And so if we want to take the variation of det m, well, varying an exponential always gives us the exponential times the variation of the argument of the exponential. So we've got to take delta of trace log m. Well, we know delta of log is m inverse delta m. And so we simply trace that. So that's what our variation of a determinant is. So this is telling us that delta of det g is det g, g inverse delta g. So now we know how to vary our volume form. So if we see this, for example, if we look at, this is like a derivative of root g, so we are varying root g here. So we get a half 1 over root g times minus g, gcd, gcd comma a. So that's equal to root g gamma, ddA. But this is actually quite a useful identity, because often when you're taking like the wave operator acting on a scalar, or in equations of motions with forms where you're taking a derivative of an antisymmetric object, what you end up with often is a situation where you have just one connection component with this trace, this summation of the top and bottom index. And so that means that you can usually replace the covariant derivative with partial derivatives and some factors of root g. So, for example, if you have a scalar, you can rewrite that in terms of partial derivatives and the square root of this metric. Also, if you have a two-form, or an N form, so it's quite a nice little identity. It's always useful to be able to replace covariant derivatives with partial derivatives, because with partial derivatives you kind of know where you are. That in this case, if you're summing over the index A, and for a particular coordinate, you happen to know that, say, I don't know, f theta b dot 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 is zero, then that means that you know there's no theta derivative happening here. For example, it kind of reduces the number of things that you have to think about. So, if we want to do field theory in a curved space-time, all we're doing essentially is taking our normal field Lagrangian and just using our manifold's volume integration measure to replace the d4x that would have been in our flat space action. So let's just very briefly convince ourselves this is a sensible thing to do. So if we look at a scalar field, and just simply look at the action for the scalar field, and just check we get the right equation of motion. So if I vary my scalar field action, so varying with respect to phi, I'm going to get dA delta phi, and then dv by d phi delta phi. And if I vary with respect to my metric, well, I've got something which is, there's a metric hidden in here because I'm taking the magnitude of d phi. So there's a g inverse hidden in there. And then, of course, I've got this square root of g here. So I know that from that top board, the derivative or the variation of root g is simply a half root g times g inverse delta g. So I get those terms, yep. Scalar, that's why. I mean, I could have put covariance. I don't know, I think I just used partial, but of course, knowing me, I'll probably meander off and call it a covariant derivative at some time, but it doesn't make any difference, as you point out. Okay, so I've got two parts of this variation. I've got the fact that the Lagrangian obviously depends on the scalar field, since this is a scalar field Lagrangian. But now that I'm thinking about it on a curved manifold, I've also got some variation with respect to the metric, the sort of background observable of gravity. So, of course, what we do with the Lagrangian approach is we integrate by parts. So integrating this bit by parts, I've got something which I've got root g d phi. I integrate by parts, pulling that derivative over onto it. And then, so I've got to multiply by 1 over root g to get this piece looking right. Then I've got my dv d phi term, and this all multiplies delta phi. Now, for the second term, I'm actually going to change, rather than varying with respect to g, just for convenience, I'm going to vary with respect to g inverse. And so I'm actually going to write here delta G inverse. So this really is delta G inverse. So here that's fine, because that's what this is. So I've got a half phi comma A, phi comma B. But now, if I want to have delta G inverse here, I have to reverse the sign. Okay, so this is now minus a half times the Lagrangian for phi. So here, what I'm actually using is the fact that delta of G inverse is sort of G inverse, basically that relation with minus sign. So as always with Lagrangian methods, we assume that the boundary terms are zero because we're not allowing our fields to vary on the boundary. So, so we say that whatever our, actually let me call it delta V, curly V. Since we don't have to integrate over the whole manifold. So our equations of motion, if we vary with respect to the field, we can see that what we have is our normal equation of motion for a massive or a interacting scalar field in a curved background. So that's our typical scalar equation in a curved background. So it's what we expect. Meanwhile, delta S by delta G Yes, I did. And then if we think about varying our scalar action with respect to the metric, we have something that looks like the energy momentum tensor. Of the phi field. So that's good news if we want to think about having an action principle for gravity, because we want to write down something which is a geometrical action that'll give us the Einstein tensor. And we know that if we write down something that represents matter, if we vary with respect to the metric, we're getting something that looks like the energy momentum tensor. So the obvious Lagrangian for gravity is the Ricci scalar. And so all we need to do is confirm that indeed that gives us Einstein equations. And we'll just be a little bit more careful about tracking through what's actually going on. Because notice that normally when you write down a Lagrangian, say like in the case for the scalar field, in a field theory, you're just generalizing a normal sort of point particle type Lagrangian. You've got sort of, you know, kinetic terms minus potential terms. So you have sort of P squared or Q dot squared minus V of Q. And that becomes a covariant d phi squared minus V of phi. So your kinetic terms are usually just the first derivatives of your field. So that's a normal kinetic term. But, sorry? Not a question. But the difference with space-time is that the first derivatives of the metric, which is our field, we don't really have a covariant object there. The first derivatives of the metric give the connection. And the whole point about connections that we've been banging on about last week is that they're not covariant objects. They kind of mop up the lack of covariance of the partial derivative. And in order to get something geometric, which is the curvature, and that's what gives you the sort of physical manifestation of gravity, the forces, you have to get the second derivative of the metric. So it's a little bit odd in that sense, gravity. That's sort of, in many ways, it's like a field theory, and in some ways it isn't. And that is because your natural kinetic term or scalar is something which has second derivatives of the metric in it. So in order to find, let's look at delta r to just see what this is going to mean for us with our equations of motion. So delta r is delta of the Ricci contracted with an inverse metric. Now remember, Ricci is the sum of the Riemann over the first and third indices, and the Riemann is this with, this is the sort of geometric curvature. So it's this geometric curvature tensor. So there's no hidden factors of G in the Ricci tensor, but there is in the Ricci scalar. So we, so in order to find delta R, so curvature squared. Yes, but then you see already the Riemann has second derivatives of the metric in it, right? So what we would like is to end up with just field equations that are second order, so that we have a well-posed problem. If you start taking higher derivative, they're called higher derivative theories, which people do, then your problem is you, unless you're careful, you end up with fourth order equations, and as a result, you tend to get instabilities or ghosts or all sorts of nasty things in your theory. So it's really the fact that you want to have a second order, a set of equations of motion like box. So that's kind of what motivates it. You want to have a second order system. But of course, people do consider higher derivative gravity. Right, so RAB, this term looks good. So put a smiley face, because that's in the Einstein tensor. But then I want to know what's going on with that term, because that term is potentially giving me something that I didn't expect. So let's, got to make sure I get these straight. Okay, so to get the variation of the Ricci tensor, we use Palatini's lemma. And in order to see how this is true, let's just kind of think about this. Delta RAB is going to be delta of the Riemann, which is contracted on the first and third indices. So we know that that's equal to the variation of gamma CAB, comma C minus gamma C So it's a variation of that expression for Riemann in terms of the connection, but there's a trick, there's a method that you can use, which is quite useful in these circumstances, called normal coordinates. Where you take a local inertial frame. So if you want to very quickly compute something where you're just looking, you want to have a quick way of getting an answer, where you want to have perhaps a more complicated expression, if you go into a local inertial frame, what I mean is you're going to a set of sort of local Cartesian type coordinates, locally flat, then what you've done, because you've made your spacetime literally like Rn locally, is you've set the connection equals to zero. You've set the connection equal to zero at some specific point P. But d gamma, or any sort of derivative of gamma, is of course not zero, because you can never kill curvature by just choosing a different set of coordinates. So what you're doing there is you're saying that just in this local frame, the Riemann tensor is given just by derivatives of the connection. But notice that because gamma is zero at P, the covariant derivative is the same as the partial derivative, again, at P. So what this is saying is that every time, to use normal coordinates, you forget about gamma, you're allowed to just set gamma to zero, but not any derivatives of gamma. You work in that frame, and then you note that partial derivatives are the same as full covariant derivatives in that frame. So let's just think about that frame, or that, just for the moment, applying it to delta RABCD. So in normal coordinates, we would say that RABCD was just gamma ABD comma C minus gamma ABC comma D. So this would then become delta gamma ABD comma C minus delta gamma ABC comma D. But then that also equals delta gamma ABD semicolon C, covariant derivative. But now look what I've got here. This difference of a connection is a tensor, and covariant derivative is also tensorial. So this last expression here is a covariant expression. So it's true whatever coordinates I have. This is only true, this first step is only true in normal coordinates. The second step is only true in normal coordinates. But the final step is true in all coordinates. And so that's how I see Palatini's lemma. So now all I have to do to complete my computation of what delta RAB is to compute what this covariant derivative of delta gamma is.
How do we see that the variation of the connection is
So if you go back, if you do it messy way and think about coordinate transformations, so the connection, if you remember, has exactly the right non-covariantness to cancel off that term in the second derivative of a coordinate transformation. And so no matter what connection you have, it's always got to have that same extra piece to cancel off the amount by which the partial derivative is not covariant. And so that's the only thing that's preventing a connection from being a tensor, and it's the same in all connections. So when you take a difference of a connection, you get that this simply cancels out, and so what's left is a tensor. So it's the reason why, well, sort of, the reason why torsion is a tensor. And if you try and think of different connections on your manifold, then the difference between them will also always be a tensor. And in this case, I'm just about to write down what this covariant derivative is. You'll kind of see why that turns out to be a tensor. So C, delta gamma, CAB, semicolon C. So once again, I'm kind of using normal coordinates here. I'm saying that my metric, of course, is covariantly constant. So the only thing that picks up any covariant derivatives is this variation of the metric, delta G. And so my covariant derivative of this variation of the connection is just picking up covariant derivatives of delta G. But of course, I want to turn these into covariant derivatives of delta G inverse. Actually, to make just want to emphasize that we're now looking at delta G inverse in that last term. So if I put all this together, I see that if I trace the variation of the Ricci tensor, I get double derivatives of delta G. So one is a D'Alembertian of delta, of the trace of delta G, and the other is just the sort of two covariant derivatives summed over the indices of delta GAB. So this is a total derivative So it's not going to contribute to any equations of motion throughout the volume or bulk of our manifold. However, when I cancelled off boundary terms to get equations of motion, I assumed that delta phi was zero on the boundary. Whereas here, if I want to do the same thing, I have got to set derivatives of delta g equal to zero on the boundary. Sorry, put the wrong index there. Finally, got it right. In other words, if you want to do a variational principle to get equations of motion, you have to set not only delta G, but derivatives of delta G equal to zero. So this is something I'm going to come back to, but I'm simply noting it for the moment. So it seems as if by taking a Lagrangian, which is given in terms of second derivatives of our variable, dynamical variable, it seems like we've gotten away with it. We've got something that looks like a total derivative. We can throw it onto the boundary. And all we're left with is that delta root gr is equal to rab minus a half r gab root g delta gab plus some boundary terms. And so that means that we can write down our Einstein-Hilbert action as the integral of root gr, and comparing with the expression of the variation of the scalar field action, we deduce that our prefactor is 1 over 16 pi g. So this gives us our Lagrangian or action principle for gravity. And along the way, we've noted that there is possibly an issue with the boundary, and that's kind of something to sort of flag up, which we'll come back to later. But what I just like to now do with this, just in the sort of last part of the lecture, is to look at what else we can do with gravity, so how we can perhaps change what our gravitational action is to modify Einstein gravity. So that's standard Einstein theory. So the next question I want to just explore or bring to your attention is, can we modify gravity? So one way of exploring how we modify gravity is to look at the Einstein action and think about doing something different with it. So one thing I want to look at is there could be a different scalar action for the geometry. Suppose instead of 1 over 16 pi g, I replace my Newton's constant with a scalar field. So let's just see where this takes us and see what we get. So this is, if by pre-multiplying r by a scalar field, it's kind of like saying our gravitational constant might not be constant. It's one way of allowing a varying Newton constant. So that's obviously a way of modifying gravity, because Newton's constant is no longer constant. So now, in terms of our action, we're taking delta phi r root g, and we're just, for the moment, we're just varying that with respect to the metric. So here we've got again phi gab delta rab plus phi Einstein tensor delta gab all times root g. But now, when we think about looking at what our delta RAB is, so we've got it there in the middle board on the left, when we integrate by parts, we don't just throw away delta RAB, because we've also now got to take derivatives of the phi field. So it actually changes what our Einstein, or effective Einstein tensor is. So this tells us that the Einstein tensor becomes modified and has terms involving this new scalar field. So this is adding this extra scalar term is called scalar tensor gravity. And the notation that I've used here is essentially the same as the first attempt in modifying gravity in this direction, and this is called this example, So if I just get the full action down. So this example was due to Brands and Dickey, and it's usually called Jordan Brands Dickey. Gravity. And what Brands and Dickey were interested in, if I just write down the full equations of motion, you see that the Einstein tensor is equal to so our Einstein tensor has some pieces that are, well, a piece that looks very like a normal scalar field, energy momentum, these stranger terms, and then a term that's normal, energy momentum tensor. So that's with varying with respect to the geometry. If I vary with respect to this new scalar field, I get that the trace, it's a bit like a sort of so if I combine these together, I see that my scalar field couples to the trace of the energy momentum. So the reason Brands and Dickey thought about this sort of gravity was something that had actually bothered Einstein right from the very beginning, and it's sort of a bit of a philosophical thing called Max principle, which is how do you, when you decide something is gravitating, how do you know what it's gravitating with respect to? In other words, if you have a bucket of water in the universe and then rotate it, the water tends to, you know, will become concave, the water surface, because it's trying the sort of centrifugal forces. So what's it rotating with respect to? And in other words, why is there, so on the one side of the Einstein equation, you've got something geometrical. On the other side, you've got something which is pure matter. And it's kind of put in a bit by hand. How does the matter sort of know how strongly to affect the geometry? And so there was this idea or Max principle that somehow it was the distant stars or the matter in the universe was kind of telling you how strongly everything was gravitating. And so here, this phi field has replaced Newton's constant. It's coupled to the matter in the universe via the trace of T. And so it's the more matter you put in, the more phi will respond. So it's kind of saying that gravity or the strength of gravity is related to the matter there, sort of, okay? And so that was the idea behind it. But of course, the problem with Brands-Dickey or any modification of gravity is that although gravity is in some ways very hard to test, there are quite a lot of constraints that we know gravity has to obey. So you will have seen some of the examples within the solar system. So we know Einstein gravity works pretty well at the sort of astronomical unit scale. We actually also know from lab experiments that the Newtonian style gravity works down to distances of, let's say submillimeter scale. And depending, I suppose it depends on how conservative you are as to say, well, how far we know for sure Einstein gravity works. But there's good reason to believe that it certainly works out to the sort of kiloparsec scale. So provided we take on board dark matter, then we're out to sort of galactic scales. And again, if we, or even, I suppose, megaparsec scales. And if we take on dark energy, then we would say Einstein gravity was just fine for the universe at large. However, it still sort of leaves us the fact that at very large scales, sort of the galactic scale or supergalactic scale, we have to start positing extra sources. Also gives us a little bit of room to play in the sense that we could also imagine modifying gravity to try and get, for example, ultra-large scales modification of gravity, so we're talking at the sort of mega-gigaparsec scale, and we can even try modifying gravity at the galactic scale to see if we can mock up something that looks like dark matter. So although I think there's good reasons to have a bit of confidence in dark matter, although there's no direct detection, nonetheless, it's still good to explore alternatives so that you can at least compare it to other theories. Right, I better stop there.